From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a big blow-up between the state attorney general and former MSU interim president John Engler adds more turbulence for MSU with the state probe into the Larry Nassar scandal.
They want to be seen as cooperating, as being fully transparent, as moving forward. And then situations like this happens, and it's a media firestorm, and it just takes all the air out of the room.
GM, Ford, and President Donald Trump.
And you can start to see behind the scenes the automakers actually vying for the political favor of the president.
Rethinking public transit in Michigan's urban areas.
You know, I think it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing that we see empty buses and we tell ourselves it's inefficient, so why are we going to fund it? But you're never going to have a good system until we fund it.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan, when it comes to public transportation, we can and should do better for everyone's sake. That's the message of a newly released paper from the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. It's called Rethinking Regional Transportation in Michigan's Urban Areas. And that word, rethinking, is very key. Let's talk about this as we welcome Eric Lufer with the Citizens Research Council and Megan Owens, Executive Director of Transportation Riders United. Good to have you both here to talk transportation. You know, you look at Chicago, New York, Toronto, Washington, D.C., just to name a few examples, where people living in a city don't need a car to get around. And you hear Michiganders say, why can't we have that kind of transportation here? Eric, why can't we?
Well, I mean, clearly we have to go back in history and know that the autos ruled supreme, and there's a lot of pushback on having buses or light rail playing part of it. But those days are long past, and now we've just gotten stuck where, you know, I think it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing that we see empty buses and we tell ourselves it's inefficient, so why are we going to fund it? But you're never going to have a good system until we fund it. So what comes first? We're saying it's time to invest in it and really put it up on the pedestal it needs to, and it's the future of mobility. If we don't invest now, we're going to get left behind.
And this report is about rethinking regional transportation. Let's talk about rethinking, Megan. We have spent generations around here thinking of public transportation as, air quotes here, a way to get around for people who don't have cars, seeing it as a social welfare program, a poor person's problem. Where does that thinking come from? Is it unique to Michigan as the home of the automobile?
No, it's not necessarily unique. A lot of people assume that if you can drive, that's the best way to get around, but they don't necessarily look at all of the costs that go along with driving, whether that's the actual financial costs of nearing $10,000 a year to own and operate a car, but also the social costs of how much time we spend stuck in a car staring at the bumper in front of us and not walking around our community. Unfortunately, it's pretty common to perceive, in outside of major cities, to perceive transit as a social service. But if you get into most cities, the property value benefit of having great transit is huge, and is not something that most cities want to miss.
Eric Lufer, that looking at public transportation as a social welfare program, where has that led us?
Well, it's led us to a great underinvestment in transit. We've had people move away from our inner cities for whatever reason, sprawling further and further away. And once they're out there, they're put up the gate and say, that's it. Those are your problems now. You deal with it. So, you know, sort of bad on us that we've had Detroit go through the condition it has. And getting into downtown Detroit isn't as hard as getting into downtown Chicago or New York or Washington, D.C. It's coming back, and there's going to be more and more traffic. So again, do we want to wait until traffic is so bad that you're spending an hour getting into downtown, or are we going to invest now and have a system in place so that we can rebuild Detroit?
So let's go beyond that. What could a full-throated, functional, modern public transit system look like without us having to take 3 hours to get somewhere or change modes of transit multiple times? What do you think, Megan?
Well, my office is in Tech Town in Midtown Detroit, and when I want to go to a meeting downtown, I have a car, I could drive, but finding a parking place, paying for it, is really a huge hassle. In that downtown, midtown Detroit area, I actually have a lot of other choices. I can get on the Mogo bike share and have a nice bike ride if the weather is good. There are e-scooters around that I can take if I want to do that. There are three different bus lines that go in the same area. There's the Q line streetcar. That 3 mile stretch of Detroit has a ton of different options for getting around. Now, the question is, how do we provide those types of options throughout all of Michigan so that when you need to get from one place to another, you can think about which mode you would like to use, which way you would choose to get there, not how bad's the traffic going to be and where do I have to park as being the only options.
I'm speaking with Megan Owens of Transportation Riders United and Eric Lufer of the Citizens Research Council talking about the CRC's new report, Rethinking Regional Transportation in Michigan's Urban Areas, which brings us to regional. Right now, we have all these little different silos for governance. And what does the report recommend, Eric, for ways to build regional governance for a regional system?
So we have to start with thinking about what the authority is going to be about and who is it for. Right now, we've created the RTA, the Regional Transit Authority, and membership, the board is composed of representatives from the member counties in the city of Detroit. And we really question that. If it's going to be serving people, it should be represented by people. We should go back to what Lansing and reconstitute that authority to give it real input into planning and zoning and economic development. If we're going to be asking the bus system, SMART and DDOT and all these, to be serving the property, serving the people, they should have some say in that. If we continue to sprawl further and further away, if we continue to build properties with all this parking in front of them so you can't have to walk a great distance to get off the bus and into the building, that's really not very friendly for transit. So we need to give the authority some say in that. And then we need to think about funding it. And a regional funding system should not include a property tax. It is probably the funding source least conducive to thinking about the region as a whole. You're thinking about how does it affect my property value? How does it affect my neighborhood? How does it affect my city? Not how does it affect the whole region. So most places use a local option sales tax. That's really a tough climb in Michigan. Mm-hmm. But there's local option income taxes. We could do that on a regional basis at a fairly low rate and accomplish good things.
And it seems that goes right back to the point that is so central to this report, is that we need to stop looking at public transportation as this social welfare program, that this is something that benefits everybody because of what it can mean for living in 21st century Michigan.
I think you're totally right. For too long, the city or county boundaries have dictated whether you can get to a job or get to another opportunity, and we've carved out there's so much political squabbling over what percentage of money goes exactly back within what county. When I travel all throughout, I ride the bus throughout all four counties. I may live in Oakland County, but I work in Detroit and I visit Macomb and I've got family in Ann Arbor. It really should be a much more seamless connection between systems. And when that started to happen, people respond. When we make it easy, more and more people will choose to ride, but we do need to make those regional connections much easier to do.
Eric, why don't we hear more talk about taxing sports and entertainment events?
You know, during the Granholm administration, they tried to expand the sales tax to include more services, and they did it about as poorly as you could do it, and just, you know, the devil's in the details. So now they're really gun-shy on expanding it to more services. I just did a presentation a couple days ago where I was looking at Michigan's tax competitiveness and used a source that surveyed the different states and looked at how many services are included, and we're at the bottom of that. So we could expand the taxation, include services. You think about, you used to buy a house and the first thing you do would go buy a lawnmower, and now the first thing you do is engage a lawn service. And so it just really is emblematic of how our economy is changing, and we're missing out on a lot of things. So, you know, clearly services, that's a huge part, not only in downtown Detroit, but every movie theater and every community and local theater and whatever. So there's lots of opportunities. I wouldn't limit it just to entertainment, though. I think there's a lot of opportunities to do more, and it wouldn't be a huge burden on anyone.
There's a number of cities that that have, specifically looking at entertainment and sporting events, that have incorporated transit into that. Parking is difficult and expensive around these stadiums and such. So they've actually incorporated in. When you buy your sports ticket, I believe Denver, Dallas are places that have these, your baseball ticket, your football ticket, it already includes a transit pass in it. So whether you ride it or not, it then makes it that much easier for people to use transit to get down to the game, to then not have to deal with the $45 parking, and then to not have to worry about getting the DUI on the way home. Mm. Things like that do introduce transit to people who may not be able to use it on an everyday basis, but would love to be able to use it once in a while to go to a ball game or go to the airport or other entertainment options like that.
We could actually gallop through this for a whole hour. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I just want your final thoughts, Eric, on what you hope will come from this report.
We put this report out really hoping to start the dialogue. We're under no pretense that we have all the answers, but we have to start the dialogue. We're hoping in November of 2020 that we'll be thinking about how to fund the RTA, and I think we're far enough out that we can go back and think about some of the elements of the RTA, and you know, let's have the dialogue. Let's think about how we could do this better. So our report is on our website at crcmich.org, and we hope people will come and, you know, let's talk.
Eric Lufer, Citizens Research Council, and Megan Owens, Transportation Riders United. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. It's great to
be
here.
Up next, the life of world-famous illusionist Harry Houdini.
Famously, he would be thrown from bridges into icy rivers, including the Detroit River.
Plus Houdini's tragic final visit to Detroit after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This Sunday marks the 145th birthday of famed magician and illusionist Harry Houdini, born in Budapest, Hungary, March 24, 1874. But it was his death in Detroit on Halloween 1926 that made international headlines. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back here with us. Before we get to that oh-so-famous death, tell us about Houdini. He was the son of a rabbi?
Yeah, he was born Eric Weiss in Budapest. He emigrated to the United States when he was 4 years old. They settled in Appleton, Wisconsin, where his father became the rabbi of the Reformed congregation there. And Eric was far more interested in magic and acrobatics and playing around than he was in the Talmud, and he ran away.
As a little boy?
As a 9-year-old boy and joined the circus.
So this was something that did not come later in life. He just kind of grew up interested in this.
Yes, and for a long time he worked as a trapeze artist and as an acrobat, as a contortionist. He always had a great physical body. He worked on his muscles, you know, he exercised. That was a big part of his act. But he also got very good at picking locks. And so part of his act when he was still with the circus was to say to anybody, you can tie me up and put me in this little clothes booth and I will escape.
You write about a great story from Kansas.
Yeah.
With handcuffs, right?
Yeah, it was Coffeeville, Kansas. And a sheriff said, you know, I will put you in my cuffs and you will not get out. Well, he did get out. And then he became a bigger star, and he became a huge vaudeville star, going from city to city for dozens of years, and was an international celebrity as the great Houdini.
And where did that come from? When did he morph from Eric to Harry Houdini?
Well, it was about the time he became a headliner, and there was a great magician, a French magician named Robert Houdin. And now, Houdini did not speak French, so he thought adding an I to the name meant Houdin-like.
Oh, okay.
And so he became Houdini. And he preferred to be called Houdini or the Great Houdini, as opposed to Harry Houdini. And Harry may have come from his nickname. It was Eric or Erish, and Harry may have been his nickname when he was a child.
Always wondered about that. So he really was the David Copperfield, I guess would be the closest to as far as fame or beyond.
I think better. Certainly as far as fame. I mean, you know, even in the sticks, like in Coffeyville, they knew who Harry Houdini was. And he kept upping the game. So when he went to Europe to travel in 1900, he escaped from Scotland Yard. And then he went to other famous prisons around Europe. And then he got even more creative. By 1908, he would be put into a vessel filled with water. And he was all manacled and tied up, and yet he would get out. Or he'd be hanging off of a skyscraper, and he would still manage to emerge free. And famously, he would be thrown from bridges into icy rivers, including the Detroit River, and he would escape in a very clever way. Back before global warming, the Detroit River would freeze over, and many other rivers would too. But there'd be little ice pockets, and he would breathe. He would put his head in the ice pocket under ice and breathe some air while he was escaping and buy himself some time that way.
Okay. I did not know that he was thrown into the Detroit River.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about the incident in Montreal. It was October 1926
It was October 22nd, 1926. He was at the Princess Theater. He had recently broken his foot, so he was resting on a chaise lounge in his dressing room. And he had just given a lecture at the McGill Medical School a few days earlier. He was a great exposer of spiritualists and mediums, which was a huge trend back then. And so he gave a talk about that at McGill. And a couple of medical students came to visit him backstage. And, you know, because he had this great physique, he would often allow people from the audience to either feel his muscles or punch him in the gut. And so the medical student said, "Mr. Houdini, can I punch you in the gut?" And he said, "Okay." But the student punched him twice very hard before Houdini had a chance to tighten his muscles and brace himself. And on the third strike, Houdini actually caught his arm and said, "That's enough." Mm. So he had this pain both in his foot and in his gut. In his abdominal muscles, per se. And he had to leave. He had to go from Montreal to Detroit, where he had a gig at the Garrick Theater, which was, I looked it up, the old Garrick Theater was on Griswold and Michigan Avenue, so okay. Right near Lafayette, Coney Island.
Right downtown.
And he finally saw a doctor. His wife, Bess, was his assistant, and she insisted on him seeing a doctor. And by this time, Houdini had a fever about 104 degrees Fahrenheit. But Houdini said, you know, the show must go on. I'll give this show if it's my last. He went on. He did not give his best performance, but unlike a lot of movies and apocryphal tales, he didn't collapse on the stage, nor did he have to be axed out of the water torture as in the old Tony Curtis movie. And then he was very ill after that. He went to his hotel and his wife insisted he go to the hospital. They took him to Grace Hospital, mm-hmm. what we used to call Old Grace
Old
versus
Grace.
New Grace.
Willis and John R.
Exactly.
Before Grace moved to Northwest Detroit.
Exactly. Boy, there's a lot of gray hair on
there
our heads.
Is. So right in the heart of what we know as the DMC.
As the DMC. And he had an operation, an emergency operation on the 26th of October. The appendix had already burst and so he had peritonitis, a terrible infection of the abdominal cavity. He had another operation on the 28th. There was no antibiotics, although they gave him an anti-streptococcal serum, which was sort of a pre-antibiotic in that day. It didn't work very well. And sadly, Harry Houdini succumbed to overwhelming sepsis on October 31st, 1926.
And is there any sense whether it was just his bad luck to have gotten appendicitis right when he got punched in the stomach in Montreal, or did the punch cause it? Do we have any idea?
Well, that's the great question. And so this man, Gordon Whitehead, who hit him in the gut, probably felt he killed Houdini to the end of his life. But what's called a traumatic or blunt force appendicitis is exquisitely rare. It happens, but it's not a very common entity. And most surgeons today believe that they were probably coincidental. And in fact, the blows may have contributed in that it gave him a false reason for his pain. He didn't expect to have something brewing in his gut that could kill him because of the musculoskeletal pain. So that may have had something to do with his demise. He was only 52, by the way.
Fascinating story. Well, a happy 145th birthday to Harry Houdini. And thanks, as always, to University of Michigan medical historian, Dr. Howard Markell.
Thank you.
There is triumph. There is tragedy. There are secret late-night meetings and tense flights out of Russia. And there's the impact five Russian hockey players made on the hearts of Red Wings fans in Michigan and beyond. All of that and more is contained in the documentary film The Russian Five. It debuted a year ago at the Free Film Festival in Detroit. This week, it's opening at theaters all across Michigan, as well as in other states. We've got director Joshua Reel and producer Jenny Fedorovich back with us on Stateside. Welcome back, and what a year you guys have had.
Thank you for having us back.
Thank you.
I have to start by congratulating you on getting your film from the festival to a whole bunch of theaters. How many are set to show The Russian Five starting this Thursday?
So at the moment, we're up to 51. Theaters.
That is pretty impressive.
Yes.
And you've got the upper and lower peninsulas covered. I mean, from Marquette to Portage, Grand Rapids to Port Huron, Monroe to Harbor Springs and more. But you're also outside of Michigan.
Yeah, we're in Denver, which will be interesting. We're playing in Austin for a showing.
Seattle, we're in Columbus, and the demand has just been huge, actually. The grassroots demand is actually bigger than the film buyer demand. So I think what we're going to see happen, which is really interesting because we're doing our own theatrical release, is that people are really going to demand the theaters out of state to bring this movie there.
Hockey fans just they want it's a hockey
expats.
Story.
Yeah.
And Michigan expats.
Yeah.
So the story that you tell in The Russian Five is how these five hockey players who became known as The Russian Five got away from Russia and came to Detroit to help power the Red Wings to Stanley Cup glory. And just to remind everybody, the players we're talking about are
Sergei Fedorov, Vladimir Konstantinov, Slava Kozlov, Igor Larionov, and Slava Fetisov.
And they're names that are certain, they're engraved on Stanley Cups now. But when you stop about, think about before they came, how bad were the Wings before general manager Jimmy Devolano started thinking that the key to turning them around lay in Russia?
They were terrible. I mean, they were the dead Wings. So if fans right now are having pains of what's going on, they don't know. You know, it's nothing compared to what the Red Wings have been through. And so they'll turn it around again. You know, it's a process. But you know, there was a season where I think they had maybe like less than 60 points the whole season. It was really bad. And so, you know, Jimmy D started thinking, you know, well, we can only get one or two, maybe three good players in a draft if we're drafting in a, you know, Canadian, North American guys. But his scouts told him, you know, there's some really fantastic Russian players and Europeans. Like, forget Nick Lidstrom was a third round pick in that 89 draft where they got Sergei in the fourth round. So, you know, they kind of went out of the box when no one was doing it, and they got ahead of the curve, and, you know, we in Detroit were the beneficiaries of that.
And, Jenny, how much risk was there for a Russian player and that player's family in defecting?
I mean, the risk was tremendous. It was everything. And that's why when you watch the movie, you'll see, we don't want to give away the movie, but they were very reluctant. And it wasn't like it was the first time that, you know, the people came and they said, oh, come with us, defect. And they said, sure, let me just run off. Absolutely, that did not happen. I mean, in the Soviet Union at that time, anything was possible. Your family could have gotten arrested. Anything could have happened. So the risk they took was tremendous.
And we do see some, we'll call them cloak and dagger moments in getting these players finally to Detroit. And then even though the Russian Five are firmly established in the hearts of Red Wings fans now as we speak, your film shows us that at first not everybody was glad to see Russians in the Wings lineup. Let's take a listen. Here's GM Jimmy Devolano.
Growing up in America, right or wrong, fair or unfair, we were kind of trained to be those Russians, they're bad people. They're against us. We sort of had that mentality, even me a little bit. But all I was concerned about was how can I get good world-class players for the Red Wings?
And then there was this from Steve Yzerman.
The ideology is different. Their values are different. It's just they grew up in a different system, and as a result, they thought differently than us.
And they did finally get integrated into the Detroit Red Wings system, brought their mark, left their mark. But Jenny, I'm wondering how Russians back home thought of those five and think of them today.
Well, today they're heroes. of course. I mean, a lot of them have returned back home. I mean, Sergei's back home. He's the general manager of the Red Army team. Slava Fetisov actually became a politician. I mean, he was teaching Putin how to play hockey very well, by the way. Putin was winning every time he stepped on the ice. That's a whole other story.
Yes, indeed.
I would hate to be the goalie on the opposing side of Putin. You know, Slava Kozlov is there. Igor Larionov just opened a gym, opened a business. So the people have embraced them. At that time that they were defecting or going away, honestly, the country was in such chaos. I mean, the early 90s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, nobody knew what was happening. I mean, it was total chaos. So I don't know if people had time to really think, oh, they're traitors, they betrayed our country. You know, I don't know if they had time to look at it like that, but I'm sure some people did.
And then, of course, you do take us in the film very emotionally into June 1997, the tragedy of that limo crash, 1 week after the Stanley Cup victory. Joshua, what did you take away as you talked with the players, you talked with Scotty Bowman about this accident that left Vladimir Konstantinov and Sergei Manatsakhanov so terribly and permanently injured?
I mean, it still affects everyone. What'd be interesting is I learned through the process to stop doing my interviews chronologically, because everyone would start to get anxious and nervous after we talked about the cup. And you think like, oh, that's the moment where you should be really jubilant. But they all knew what was coming next. And so the tension started to come in. Yeah, it's still hard. You know, Sergei Fedorov actually, you know, choked up in the interview and he shut us down. Said, sorry, guys, like, I can't talk about it. And then I asked him about the fan response to the accident and the vigils they made. And so we started talking about that and realized he was talking about it again, and he cut himself off. And at that point we saw like tears forming in his eyes. And, you know, it, for someone who everyone thinks of this calm, cool, collective Mr. Cool, to see him really get emotional in that moment, which was the most emotional he was in the entire interview. Like it told me that these guys are still wrecked about that.
So let's talk about what it has taken for you to get the Russian Five from film festivals like the Freep Festival a year ago, and now it is in theaters. Those of us who don't know the business don't know what that takes.
Blood, sweat, tears multiplied by hundreds of thousands. honestly, we played at festivals. It was great. Accolades, audience awards. It was all great. But at the end of the day, it's a movie business. You know, we have an investor. He invested money. We have to take the movie to the audience. We have to make it back. Throughout the process, we somewhat always felt that Hollywood didn't have a buy-in into this because it's not a story close to them. You know, I think at times people look at us, oh, they're like this filmmakers from Michigan making a Michigan story.
A little Michigan story.
Yeah, it's a little cute film. So when the box office comes out this weekend, I think we'll revisit that with some Hollywood folks, because I know people of Michigan are going to get up and support us this weekend and following weeks. So it took a lot of negotiating. It took a lot of convincing. First time, it's a team of 3.5 of us doing a job of 50 people. And we would literally cold call buyers and we would say, we want this in your theater. Imagine we had a buy-in right away. Paul Gantz and his group, they're like, we're in. We started calling other theaters. It wasn't buy-in right away. So I think, you know, we've been selling things for a long time. So we've convinced people to come on this journey with us, and it slowly developed. So now we're getting that buy-in from out of state, and we're convincing people to come on this journey with us that I think is going to end up really great.
Well, so again, over 50 theaters,
yeah.
And when you go to the website, therussian5.com, you'll find the list of theaters and cities and links for showtimes where the film will be playing. What struck you most about the audience reactions as you've gone around on the circuit, you've shown it, you had a very powerful screening for the Freep Film Festival where you brought out Vladimir Konstantinov and the place fell down. What struck you about audiences?
I mean, that was extremely special. And for me, Vladdy's the reason why I'm here. And so to make the movie, to share that experience with him was incredible. But, you know, one of the things that have stood out in the festival run was after every single screening, there'd be two, maybe three, maybe four people come up to me and say, you know, my boyfriend or my girlfriend is a hockey person. I'm not. I came with them, but I enjoyed this movie just as much. So thanks. And so to move someone to the point where they felt compelled to approach me and tell me that, it was pretty special. And so that's why we also think that it can reach beyond just the sports crowd, the hockey fan. There's a human story there. And I think, you know, right now we're in a time where we need these human true stories that are uplifting and remind us that everything's not all dark and gloomy and stressful. And, you know, yeah, there's dark and gloom in the movie, but, you know, the team rallied around that. And I think that's a message that we can all sort of learn from.
And of course, the Vladdy thing, we want more people to know his story because younger generation is not necessarily familiar. And I don't know if you know this, but we're giving a piece percentage away from the film sales to Vladimir Konstantinov Special Needs Foundation that was set up because we feel like he needs that support. Nobody thought he'd live past a year, and it's been 20 plus years that he's been living. And with the family, we've set up a GoFundMe where people can go and donate to that foundation as well.
Wonderful. Well, The Russian Five opening at theaters all across Michigan, and we've been talking with producer Jenny Fedorovich and director Joshua Reel. Thanks for coming back to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Getting rid of grades, A, B, C, D, E, F, those five letters that have been the rubric by which we've measured learning for a long time. Do they make sense for today's students? That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump was in Ohio Wednesday at a tank plant, and he had GM on his mind.
What's going on with General Motors? We have the best economy we've ever had. We have the lowest unemployment that we've had in 51 years. Soon will be the record all time. And what's going on with General Motors? Get that plant open or sell it to somebody and they'll open it. Everybody wants it. Sell it to somebody or open it yourselves. Get it going now. And the UAW will help you. The UAW, you're going to help.
That presidential barb, of course, about GM's closing its Lordstown plant. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, get that plant open. It isn't that simple, is it?
No, it's not. And I think GM, if it had its druthers, would love to have the business for it to stay open. But they've been building compact cars there, and demand for those vehicles is plummeting throughout the market. GM was pretty much the last of the Detroit three automakers to exit that part of the market. Ford has done it. Fiat Chrysler did it a couple of years ago. So here we are. The president is making automaking very politicized. I don't think there's any question about it. And you can start to see behind the scenes, the automakers actually vying for the political favor of the president.
Because as you note in your column, on the very same day, Ford announces, hey, guess what? We're investing $900 million in our Flat Rock plant. We're creating 900 jobs. And
that's
as
right.
You say, who says the auto industry doesn't do politics?
Exactly. And my colleague, Ian Thibodeau, who covers Ford, was so frustrated because he said, you know, they announced this in 2017. They've just repackaged some of it, moved a few things around. The numbers are basically the same, but they pop it on the same day that he's going to be in Lima because they know, they expect that he is going to continue his attack on General Motors that he launched really pretty aggressively over the weekend on Twitter. And they were right. Meanwhile, General Motors is pushing paper to reporters and columnists saying, just to remind you, these are the numbers. This is what we've invested in the U.S. This is what we've invested in Ohio, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an ongoing back and forth in your inboxes, getting these things throughout the day. And you realize that, or at least I did, that this is a very political process. And the companies are trying to position themselves because they have to deal with this White House one way or another. There's a lot of policy issues hanging out there, foremost right now being trade and tariffs and issues like that. And they really have to know where they're coming from.
And for the president, talk about the politics of this hyper-focus on Lordstown and Ohio.
Well, Ohio is I'm a native Ohioan. I'm from Canton, Ohio, and Canton, Ohio has picked the winner in just about every presidential election going back I don't know how many decades. It's just a bellwether state. And the president carried Ohio big in 2016. As everybody knows, he carried Michigan, he carried Wisconsin, he carried Pennsylvania. A president, particularly a Republican, is likely cannot carry and not win re-election or election if he doesn't carry at least Ohio or Michigan. I think the likelihood that he carries Michigan is increasingly not good. Ohio's a different story. And so when Lordstown closes, and he's been touting auto manufacturing jobs and telling people, as he said in a speech, a year ago, don't sell your homes, don't leave, auto manufacturing is coming back. And people in Lordstown are going, well, but it's not happening to us. So politically, and I went and looked at some recent polling on this, the president is underwater, his approval ratings ranging from like 17% in, I think it was, I can't remember which state, somewhere in the Midwest, to 23% in Michigan, 19% he's underwater in Ohio. That's one poll, that's one snapshot. You can't put a lot of stock into it, but it does suggest that those battleground states and those industrial Midwest states that delivered him to the White House are souring on him, at least for the near term. Additionally, I think both Ford and General Motors are talking about how the tariffs on steel and aluminum have raised their costs and cut their profitability. And when GM announced some of the plant actions back in November, CEO Mary Barra actually talked about that. So the president is having to reckon with the fact that his policies are having an effect. And he still is holding out there the possibility of putting tariffs on imported vehicles. And that would hit General Motors harder than it would hit Ford or Fiat Chrysler, because they are bringing product in from China, South Korea, and Germany, as to use three examples, that they are selling in the United States to American customers. Ford is not doing that. Their U.S. product principally comes from the NAFTA region, Canada, Mexico, the U.S. All of their pickups are built in the United States, which is not the case for GM and Fiat Chrysler. So there's a lot of issues here attendant, and what actions he may take on foreign imports could have a real impact on jobs again here in this part of the country.
And it'll be interesting when the president holds his West Michigan rally 1 week from tonight, what gets talked about with respect to General Motors and the auto industry.
Yes, I hope you'll be there. I won't.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
You bet.
If there's been one constant in education through the decades, it is the report card. And along with it, the fear that you feel before you open that letter or an email to see this semester's grades. But some educators have started to question whether the traditional A through F grading system makes sense for today's students. Here to discuss why is stateside education commentator and Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz with us via Skype. Matinga, make the case for us. Why should teachers and schools move away from an A through F grading system? Why doesn't this make sense anymore?
Well, for one, standardized letter grades date back to like the 19th century. And here in Michigan, we are asking ourselves whether letter grades are effective tools to talk about how students are learning. Do they actually paint the whole picture? Are we ignoring some outliers by just focusing on those five letters? So in America, you know, there are many innovative people that have founded, you know, the wealthiest companies in our country. And some of these people have dropped out of formal academic programs. So it's making us think.
I want us to hear from a teacher that you spoke with who is actually moving away from using grades in their classroom. This is Grayson McKinney, a fourth grade teacher in Troy.
A B plus is not that different from an A minus. And the thing that determines the difference might have been something that a teacher gave as, you know, extra credit, or bring in a box of Kleenex and you'll get 20 more points. You're muddying the waters when you include learning behaviors and then also looking at, you know, the content knowledge and their mastery of the skills.
So, Matinga, let's dig into that a little bit. What does Grayson mean when he says that traditional A through F report card is muddying the waters? What information do you get if you ditch the traditional report card?
In that particular example that he gave, in such a good example, it just shows you how little a letter grade tells you about how the student achieved that knowledge. But in the non-traditional, these new ways, we're trying to include more of the learning experience rather than just a moment in time in that student's learning experience.
Let's talk about how a new model of grading could actually work. This is an example from your conversation with fourth grade teacher Zach Rondo, who also teaches in Troy.
We created like a hands-on assessment where we sit down with the kids and say, take these wires, these batteries, these light bulbs, and build me a circuit that you can turn on this light bulb with the switch. And through that process, you can actually see the kids learning and you can hear them talk through it.
So what does a student and teacher get out of this hands-on assessment like that one that you couldn't get from a pencil and paper test?
Well, for one, it's not just a teacher telling you what to think. It's a teacher training you to think differently so that you can become more of a self-directed learner in the future. As teachers, we really are forced not only to create environments that are more of a mastery learning or a competency learning and learning environment, But also we have to create a way to assess this new way of teaching.
I want to look at selling this to parents. For those of us who grew up, and that's everybody, getting that report card at the end of every semester and you look to see whether you got an A or a B or whatever, that A through F system seems easier to understand than a model where you're grading individual skills. So how do you help, especially parents, understand where their student stands with a skills-based evaluation?
Well, parents value the letter grades because we as experts have basically made them value the letter grades. And so for us, that, you know, that letter grade was what was important. So in order to onboard parents today, what we need to do is create schools or academic learning programs. They're more of a spectator sport, so that, you know, we have to teach in ways where teachers and students can publicly demonstrate what goes on in the classroom. So learning showcases, for example, where students can share their experiential knowledge in really unscripted ways, for example, will give parents a chance to see their children being brilliant. Because when you see your child being brilliant, you don't really care how they got them to think and speak that way.
And those teachers you spoke with are really doing a good example of that, aren't they?
They are. You know, Zach, he is now the Oakland County Elementary School Teacher of the Year, and I'm so excited about that. Both of them, they are assessing students differently in the way that they are actually making their fourth and fifth graders host these podcasts where the kids get to reflect on what they're learning and sharing that knowledge with the world. It's so important for now for teachers to share with the community and create a different narrative of what goes on in our classroom so that they can understand the way that we are assessing. So no, it's not about getting rid of the letter grade. It is about, you know, creating a system that aligns better with the modern teaching and learning values. Does that make sense?
It does. But I have to ask you this. There are kids who have traditionally not done so well, haven't thrived in that kind of test-based environment, who might do better in a mastery-based model. But what about kids who are succeeding with the current model? Are we training, favoring one kind of learner over another?
That is a really interesting question, because at the beginning, when you first introduced this mastery-based, standard-based grading and assessment system, a lot of the kids who are traditionally A students, they are very uncomfortable with that because you've removed that formula, right? But because they are such good rule followers, they quickly adapt and they become successful in this system too. And what you're doing is, you know, creating a different type of learner. So they're not just following the rules now, they are actually analyzing and evaluating these rules or these particular concepts that you're putting in front of them, making them even more successful in college. So it's just making the playing field a little bit more even so that the kids are not necessarily victims of their biography. All the thinking happens in school, the assessments happen in school, and they have feedback from their parents, feedback from the community, feedback from their peers, and feedback from their teachers.
The merits of moving away from that traditional A through F grading system. We've been talking with Michigan Radio's education commentator, Hall of Fame teacher, Matinga Ragatz. As always, Matinga, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you caught some of MSU's basketball games recently, perhaps you recognize someone sitting front and center, former Michigan State University interim president John Engler. This week, pictures of Engler courtside at the Breslin Center infuriated investigators at the Michigan Attorney General's office. They say they've been trying to interview him for months as part of a criminal investigation into MSU, but they say Engler's lawyer led them to believe he wasn't going to be in the state anytime soon. Well, that fight escalated into an all-out Donnybrook between Engler's attorney and one of the AG's investigators, with the AG now demanding MSU force Engler to sit down for an interview. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells is here to break this down for us. What is going on, Kate, with this dumpster fire?
It is a mess. It is a dumpster fire where one side, like, lit the match and the other side said, I'm going to pour gasoline on this situation. So here basically is the short story and what you need to know. Everybody remembers when Engler resigned in January, he was essentially forced out. And for more than a year now, the AG's office has been investigating MSU criminally. How did they handle the Larry Nassar fallout? Did anybody lie to police? We know that there have pending criminal cases, including the one against former President Luana Simon. So Engler is gone, and the attorney general goes to MSU and says, you know, we really want to talk to Engler about what he knows. This is the guy who basically came in to handle the Nassar fallout. And then there are these other allegations they want to talk to him about, the ones that former MSU trustee George Perlis basically resigned in exchange for Engler forgiving a financial gift that he had promised to give the university but never fully paid. Yeah, Those are the allegations.
That made some pretty big headlines when that came out. So the AG's office interviewed like some 500 people in the investigation, including survivors, but getting Engler to sit down with them has been tougher. Why is that?
Well, it's on one level, Engler has a really good lawyer who wants to know what his client is getting into and wants to get as much information ahead of this as possible. If you are going into an interview like this, you want to be in control as much as possible. You want all the information. So we have these emails that the Attorney General's office released. They go back like 2 months between the AG's office and Engler's lawyer, putting together a conference call and a meeting in Lansing. And eventually, Engler's attorney throws out these dates and says, hey, what about March 26th, 27th, 28th? Engler's not going to be in Michigan during that time. Can we do it in D.C.? The AG's office says, sure. They settle on March 28th. And a couple of different times in those email exchanges, the AG's investigator, Christina Grassi, says, we are doing this because you guys have told us that Engler's not going to be in the state anytime soon.
Okay. And then Tuesday, Christina Grassi sees pictures of John Engler sitting there watching the Spartans basketball game. She feels like she's been played.
Yeah. This back and forth with the AG's office and Engler's attorney has always been pretty fraught. It's been very civil up until now, but you can tell from these emails that the investigators have worried that Engler was forum shopping or basically trying to have this interview in D.C. where maybe the laws would be more lenient if he did lie to investigators, that they are essentially playing them in one way or another. And then, of course, like you mentioned, they see these pictures and everything blows up. Christina Grassi is furious. She sends off this 6 a.m. email to Engler's attorney, says the interview for March 28th is off. You lied to us. Your client was never participating in good faith. He is an embarrassment to MSU. She says even as an alum, she's embarrassed. And then her boss, Dana Nessel, who's the attorney general, sends a letter to the MSU Board of Trustees saying, hey, you guys need to make sure that Engler comes, sits down in Lansing with my investigators in the next 2 weeks. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay.
So now the Board of Trustees is involved again and on the hot seat.
And we know from what you've read in all these emails, Engler's attorney had a rather fiery response to this.
Oh, big time. First of all, he says, look, I never told the AG's office that Engler wasn't going to be in Michigan until our interview. That's ridiculous. He owns a house here. His family's here. He says it's like you're trying to make it sound like Engler snuck into that basketball game in disguise. He says, look, Engler has been fully cooperating. He voluntarily agreed to this interview. We were going to do it next week. You're canceling it. And then he sends additional 3 pages of that letter are basically personally attacking the AG's investigator, Christina Grassi, we mentioned. He says, clear that you are biased against Engler. And then this is a quote that really I just want to read. He says, your conduct diverges so drastically from the most basic principles of fairness, justice, and what is right. You've undermined the integrity of your own investigation, which may be a result of your lack of experience handling criminal prosecutions, this being your first. So you get a sense of the tone that these emails take.
And so we've got this showdown at the OK Corral. And certainly, as you point out, the Board of Trustees now in the hot seat. So bottom line, another snafu between MSU and the AG's office over whether MSU is cooperating with these investigations as they promised they would.
Yes. And that for MSU is what matters here. They want to be seen as cooperating, as being fully transparent, as moving forward. And then situations like this happens and it's a media firestorm and it just takes all the air out of the room.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, thanks for going through those 55 pages of emails for us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
And speaking of Attorney General Nessel, 5 years ago this day, then practicing attorney Dana Nessel won a lawsuit representing April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, a same-sex couple who wanted to be married and adopt their kids together. The ban on same-sex marriage in Michigan ended for one day before it was upheld by the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. DeBoer v. Snyder would become one of the central cases that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide 1 year later through a decision from the United States Supreme Court. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.